Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Now, in England, more people living with obesity will soon have access to the latest weight loss drugs following the announcement of a £40 million two-year pilot scheme. It comes after NICE, the organisation that publishes guidance on the use of new treatments, gave approval for the medical use of the appetite suppressant semaglutide, marketed as Wegovy, earlier this year. Now, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has stated that the new drug could be a game changer for the obesity epidemic, especially with obesity costing the NHS £6 billion a year. Critics, however, say that patients put the weight back on soon after stopping treatment. So, how effective is semaglutide? Are we committing people to a lifetime of treatment? And what could it all mean for the fight against obesity? Well, with me to discuss this are two fantastic guests, two, however, very busy men. So, unfortunately, we couldn't get their diaries to work and chat to them both at the same time. Later in the podcast, we'll be hearing from Jason Halford, Professor of Biological Psychology and Health Behaviours at the University of Leeds. But first, I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Adam Collins, Associate Professor of Nutrition at the University of Surrey. Hello there, Adam.
Hello there.
Thank you so much for joining us. Let's just dive straight into it, really. What is semaglutide and how does it work?
So semaglutide is what we call a GLP-1 agonist. Now, that sounds very technical, but GLP-1 is a naturally released peptide that comes from the gut. It stands for glucagon-like peptide. And its job really is to respond mainly to presence of carbohydrate, but also other things in the gut. And it's sort of part of your hormonal feedback loop between your gut and your brain. So one of the roles it has is to help your gut deal with the incoming substrates from that food, the fuels that you're going to be taking in from the thing that you've just eaten. And it's one of what we call these incretins. And that's another technical term, but incretin sort of implies that it increases something else. And one of the things it does is it increases your production of insulin. So it increases your manufacturing of insulin in the pancreas and the release of that insulin. And at the same time, hence the name glucagon-like peptide, it actually stops your liver or suppresses your liver producing the thing that does the opposite effect of insulin, which is glucagon. So that helps you deal with particularly the carbohydrates, so taking carbohydrate from the blood and taking it into your cells, and also stopping your liver manufacturing and exporting surplus glucose, which it doesn't need to do because you've just got some glucose coming in from the food. So that's sort of a bit of background as to what it is. Now, the origins of semaglutide is actually in diabetes management, because the role of that GLP-1 is obviously enhancing your ability to cope with carbohydrate, which is obviously an issue of diabetes, particularly type 2 diabetes, where your sensitivity to insulin is maybe less, or your ability to use insulin effectively is compromised. So anything that can help that is a great thing from a treatment point of view. And that's really been effective as a treatment in type 2 diabetes. And that's really where that first use of semaglutide came about, is about improving diabetes management. Now, having done that and being very successful in sort of reducing people's HbA1c, which is a marker of sort of excess glucose in the blood, all of that comes down, and you know, glucose homeostasis is better in these patients. But one of the side effects of this drug was that people were losing weight, because the effect of this GLP-1 is not just serving as an incretin because it's increasing production of insulin. It's actually feeding back to the brain and using a part of your feedback loop to say, oh, I've just eaten and I don't need to eat anymore. So it's like a communication between the gut and the brain to regulate eating. So it's part of your appetite regulation that you release this alongside other things. But this is one of the gut hormones that has a suppressing effect on appetite. So, of course, if you're artificially mimicking this by taking this drug, you're not only improving insulin's effect, but you're also going to suppress appetite as a side effect. And that's where the role of it as a standalone treatment for obesity came in, because actually we can take advantage of that side effect and use it for that sole purpose, to get people to eat less and control their appetite. So that's really where it works.
So is it basically a sort of hormonal disruptor?
It's well, that, maybe we'll come on to that a bit later, because we don't really know how it affects your normal production of GLP-1, but this is almost like an agonist. So it's acting like your own GLP-1. Yeah. So it's like you're getting a super dose of this GLP-1. So you're amplifying its effect by having more of it. Now, maybe there's a compensation for the fact you've got this artificial GLP-1 hanging around, that your body may not end up producing much of its own natural GLP-1 because it doesn't need to, because you've got this other stuff already there. So maybe that's one of the reasons why the consequences of not taking this afterwards, or, you know, when you stop the treatment, might come into play.
Yeah. Now, it's used as a diabetes treatment, and you said that the appetite suppressants is sort of a side effect. I mean, that just, I don't know anything about pharmacology, but that rings alarm bells to me, because will it carry on having the same effect on that it would have had on a diabetes patient, and therefore having its own side effects because of that?
Yeah, I mean, maybe the term side effect is saying something that's bad. I mean,
it's side not, function.
Yes, it's a known other effect of GLP-1.
Gotcha.
So it was something that obviously was going to happen anyway. If you could have predicted that was going to happen if you used it for diabetes management. Yeah. Now, let's not forget that actually diabetes management, particularly type 2 diabetes, a lot of the treatment for type 2 diabetes is weight loss or weight management, but anyway, because often it's associated with people being overweight or obese, or certainly having a lot of central fat, you know, high waist circumference, that's often associated. And we know that actually getting people to reduce their weight by 5-10%, you get all these improvements in glycemic control, better blood glucose regulation, and all these symptoms of diabetes can be alleviated. In fact, if you lose enough weight, you can, in some ways, reverse, I hate that term, but, you know, you can put diabetes in remission, essentially, by the amount of weight loss that you can create. And that's why weight loss, or particularly get people to follow maybe a very low-calorie diet, these sort of meal replacement-type diets, is one of the treatments for type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, so it does make a lot of sense. Okay, now, are there benefits to using this drug over traditional weight management methods like healthy eating, behavioural therapy and exercise? I mean, all these things require behavioural change, obviously, and that is immensely difficult. So is this a symptom of throwing your hands up in the air and saying, oh, bloody hell, none of this is working, let's turn to pharmacology?
That's a really key question, isn't it? Because we know that lifestyle modification works. So if you get people to modify their diet, increase their physical activity, whether that's to lose weight or to have better health outcomes generally, we know that's very effective. The problem is, it's very difficult to administer and it's very difficult to adhere to. Because obviously you have to change behavior, which is always tricky. And maybe your next guest will talk all about that. But this is obviously a quick fix in the sense that you don't have to think about it. And it's just doing all the heavy lifting for you, because you just inject this drug. Now it's so effective and long lasting that you only have to do that once a week. And then miraculously, your appetite is suppressed without you having to think about it. So behaviorally, you're going to eat less anyway, because you're always full. So you don't have to actually put any effort into changing your lifestyle, because it's done for you.
That sounds worrying. How do you feel? You've just used the word miraculously. I mean, there's got to be some element of irony there somewhere, I feel.
Yes, there is a little bit of irony, because with any miracle cure or something that is working like a miracle cure, you've got to think of what happens when you take that miracle cure away. What are you left with? You know, are you just relying on the miracle cure and you take no responsibility for anything else? Or are you now destined to somehow just remain using that miracle cure forevermore? Yeah. I mean, that's the problem with pharmacological interventions generally. You know, how long do you have to take it for? What happens? What do you transition into afterwards, if you can transition into something afterwards?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, there's a study into the use of semaglutide published in the National Library of Medicine, and it found that participants regained 2/3 of their weight loss after treatment ended. So I guess this is exactly as you mentioned. Now, big fluctuations in weight are known to have adverse effects for health themselves. Mm-hmm. What are these effects, and how can weight cycling be prevented in people that are using semaglutide?
Okay, so there's a couple of things to say there. So if we park semaglutide to one side for 1 minute and just look at generally weight loss, this is sort of, it sounds counterintuitive, but when someone loses weight, all of those metabolic improvements that happen as a consequence of that person losing weight, and their adipose tissue, their body fat stores shrink, and all of those things have all positive outcomes. Like with diabetes management, you know, better glycemic control, better clearance of fat from the blood, lower cardiovascular risk, all of these things improve. But all of those metabolic improvements are the very things that drive weight regain, because essentially you're now primed, and in effect, your body is reacting to that energy deficit, that sort of crisis, by being better able to soak up and replenish those stores. Not only that, and this is the more worrying thing, and goes back to this idea of weight yo-yo and why that's worse, is that in the same way as if you were driving a car and there was a petrol supply crisis and all the, well, which happened recently, you know, when people were queuing up and petrol stations and no one could fill up their car, people were filling up all manner of canisters alongside their fuel, filling their fuel tanks to the brim. They were getting, people were putting fuel in bin bags, you know, creating, filling up as much, taking as much opportunity as they can to fill up as much fuel for the next time, so they could last as longer. And that's what your body does. Mm. It actually starts creating more fat stores, because it knows, actually, I've dealt with this crisis, I better adapt to be able to cope with it better next time.
Yeah.
So that means that actually you've got a greater capacity to not just restore what you had before, but actually overshoot your original weight.
Yeah. Get fat toes.
Yeah. It's almost like dieting makes you fatter in a sense.
Yeah.
So that's generally what happens. So that metabolic improvement are the very things that drive that weight regain and potentially prime you to overshoot. Now, if you think of GLP-1, it goes back to what I said earlier. I mean, if you're artificially replacing your natural GLP-1 with doses, maybe high, very high doses of this artificial GLP-1, what happens to the natural production of GLP-1?
Yeah.
Maybe during that period of time, it's already suppressed. You don't need to do it, so your body doesn't bother. But what we know, even before we started mucking around with giving people GLP-1, that, again, one of those metabolic improvements or changes that happen when people lose weight is that their natural production of GLP-1 and all the other things that link back to appetite and all manner of stuff suppresses anyway, because, of course, they've got this metabolic improvement. So you're starting off with a lower production just because you've lost weight. So you've now got a perfect storm, potentially, where your body was already suppressing it because you were artificially supplying it, and you've lost weight, and your body's then suppressing what it did produce even more. So now, if you get rid of that GLP-1, stop injecting it, you essentially got hardly any natural producing GLP-1 to replace it. And of course, what does that mean? You're going to have a less suppressant of appetite.
Yeah. So it's a circle of pain, really. Yeah, the human body is amazing, but also really bloody annoying, isn't it?
It is. And I suppose there's arguments as to how do you get around this problem? Is it like slow and steady wins a race?
Yeah.
You know, and maybe that is one approach that your body can adapt to a gradual change in weight. And there's obviously roles of exercise that come into play there, because exercise is another thing that influences and improves things that may be conspiring against you in terms of driving that weight regain. And you know, is it a case of this short, sharp fix is part of the problem, and that's amplified by the means by which you're doing that short, sharp fix?
Yeah, but is there an element of sort of problem mitigation? You know, is there a balance to strike? If people have comorbidities or mental health issues or the other things that are associated with obesity, does a clinician need to weigh up the advantages with the disadvantages and say, okay, on balance, this person will probably benefit over the long term?
Yes. Yeah. And you're absolutely right. So, I mean, if you're saying, right, I've got to get that person to lose 20% of their body weight, getting them to just eat 500 calories a day less and do a bit more exercise is just not going to work. And we know that doesn't work. So you need to do something more, not drastic, but, you know, the intervention needs to be a bit more invasive in a way to be more effective. And that's where this perhaps has a role to play. And certainly clinically, it seems to be it's hitting that mark about 10 to 20%. And going back to that study that you quoted, yes, you're going to get weight regain, but the more that you've lost weight, the less you get to regain. So in people that are very overweight and obese, they lose more weight and they're likely to keep more of that weight off just because of the sheer amount of weight they've lost.
Yeah.
And where it's worrying, I think, and this is where, because of course, you know, the whole scandal of this is the fact that supplies of this are now being mopped up by people that probably don't even need to use it. You know, maybe they just want to like lose a couple of pounds of weight because they're not really overweight to start with.
Yeah.
And when you can look at that, the research, like the Step One trial, those people that perhaps weren't very overweight to start with and maybe only lost 5% body weight, those are the ones that not only regained that weight but overshot that original weight. And it's coming back to this idea that actually if you're really obese, then of course losing weight is the primary goal, but if you just overweight or you know then this is not the means to do it, because you're likely to overcook it and also drive potentially an overshoot of your original weight.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's, I think, the key problem that you see in society, that actually this idea of dieting makes you fatter, that when you look at people that start off lean but then start this cycle of weight yo-yoing, that they end up programming themselves to be obese. So, you know, a few years down the line, they've become obese. And there's been some interesting twin studies where, you know, if you look at weight loss attempts, you know, the twin that's actually made more weight loss attempts ends up at a higher BMI, is overweight compared to the other twin. You know, so, and that's because of this cycle of weight loss overshoot.
Yeah, the human body is its own worst enemy sometimes. Yeah. Now, what about the nuts and bolts of this? Are there any health risks associated with semaglutide usage, and any sort of clear and obvious things that we need to be aware of?
That's a slight unknown. I mean, I would say a couple of things. One is all the things that we said. The health risk is we shouldn't be looking at this, and this goes for everything, we shouldn't be looking at this as just getting someone to go from A to B, because the problem is not getting people to lose weight, it's getting people to maintain that weight once they lost it. Now, if you just did this, got them to lose the weight and then took it away again, that's not really the solution, because that's what the evidence is showing. Like everything else, you regain that weight. So you have to have something to transition into, or you have to sort of somehow wean yourself off a bit, or you've got to manage that weight maintenance. Obviously, it's better to not have been overweight in the first place. So anything that we can do to sort of make people metabolically more resilient, yeah, so that they're able to deal with an obesogenic environment that we're in, be able to eat, fluctuate in terms of their intake, but still not be susceptible to gaining weight. That's obviously the ideal, isn't it? Yeah. So I think
we've been trying that for decades.
I know. No.
We haven't got there yet.
That's like the holy grail, isn't it, of what we want. But I think the message is that we shouldn't be focusing on weight loss. We should be focusing on weight management for all manner of reasons, not just stopping people gaining weight or being obese, but also maintaining any recent weight loss. Yeah. Now, the other thing around which we don't really know is what's the other effects of this GLP-1? And maybe your next guest might know a bit more about this. But of course, when you're dealing with something, not necessarily the metabolic effects around insulin secretion and the things that it was originally designed for in terms of diabetes management, but when you start thinking of the central effect, effects on the brain, and how that is influencing appetite regulation. It's having an effect on your hypothalamus, like your sort of primitive brain that you don't really have any conscious control over. But there's a communication between that primitive brain and your higher center. And obviously eating is associated with lots of memory and reward. And you've got serotonin and dopamine and all these things that are influencing. So how that's affecting your brain chemistry. And we know that actually some drugs in the past where you've dealt with obesity by manipulating or playing around with appetite control has led to some serious issues, because you've had, so if you start to interrupt things that are providing pleasure from food and reward centers are associated with food, then that could have serious consequences. And I know there was one drug that dealt with a different mechanism related to appetite, which is your endocannabinoids, the things like your homemade cannabis, essentially, that is part of, giving you the munchies and driving pleasure from palatable foods. It was suppressing that. And then it led to people being depressed and a few suicides. So it was pulled from the market.
You mess with this at your peril, don't you?
Exactly. So messing with the brain chemistry and the neurocircuitry, we don't know. So it's too early to see that.
Okay. Now, what are your best hopes for this? A reasonably positive outcome, what might that look like from the trials that are going ahead now?
I think there is lots of positives to take from this. So I think it's obviously a very effective tool. So if you think of it as a tool, so it's part of your toolbox, you're going to use this particularly for people that are needing to maybe lose between 10 or 20% body weight, because anything less than that, probably diet and lifestyle is more appropriate. Maybe if you want to lose large amounts of weight, you're probably going to have to do something more invasive, either like gastric surgery or maybe putting them on a very low calorie diet, something more drastic.
Yeah.
But certainly it's a very effective thing in your toolbox. But it's to get you from A to B. The challenge starts once you get to B. What are you going to then do to help that person maintain B and not regain that weight, maintain that weight? Now, the fact that they've lost that weight is a key motivator, because obviously you don't want to nobody really wants to regain that weight, and they get all the benefits of being at a lower weight and all the health benefits. And so, but you need to have something in place to do that. You can't just go back to your original diet and lifestyle or think that everything's going to be perfect once you start taking this drug away or going back to normal life. So that is across the board where we should be focusing our energies.
Yeah. And bearing in mind that few interventions like that have had a huge impact yet, what do you feel is the best way ahead with trying to handle obesity here in the UK?
I think you have to have a multi-faceted approach. So obviously you've got to maintain controls on the obesogenic environment as much as possible. So we need to sort of regulate the types of things that people are exposed to in terms of diet. Also, the structure of society and the way in which we live our lives needs to obviously be engineered in a way that is helping people to follow a good diet and lifestyle. Mm. And that obviously involves legislation, policy, architecture, all manner of things that, that have to come into play with that. Obviously, education is one thing, but that alone is not going to solve the problem. But informing people and not confusing people. I mean, there's so much misinterpretation and misinformation out there on diet and lifestyle, and that is totally undermining lots of things that are going on. People like myself, you know, find it a real challenge having to sort of explain things to people because people think it's very simple. Or, you know,
battle against the misinformation.
Exactly. So all those myths and misconceptions need to be tackled. But I think we also need to recognise that we have to intervene as well. And that's where these tools come in, or using an array of tools in our toolbox to tackle things, because we have to. But recognise that it's not just a means to an end. Means of, you know, we have to look at this as a long-term maintenance thing. So and that's where the studies are. I mean, when you look at effective studies, they throw the kitchen sink at them. Obviously, they're very well controlled and they're well looked after, the participants. But when you do the ones that have done follow-ups, I mean, they're very well looked after, not just to get them to lose weight, but also to maintain that weight. And that's what we need to be doing. We need to be ensuring that people have got the support to be able to maintain that weight for all manner of reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think you've explained a very complex concept with eloquence and generosity. So, Adam Collins, thank you so much for joining me.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Now, my next guest is Jason Halford, Professor of Biological Psychology and Health Behaviours at the University of Leeds. Jason, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Stefan.
Brilliant to have you. Now, semaglutide will be available through GPs and pharmacies in line with the 2-year pilot scheme. What type of patients will be able to access the treatment? What are the qualifying factors here?
Well, initially, the NICE recommendations, which came out of March this year, was for it to be an option for weight management alongside a reduced calorie diet and increased physical activity. But there were a number of requirements, and the requirements, one of the requirements was they had to have a BMI of over 35. And we know the BMI cutoff for obesity is 30. So you had to have a significantly greater degree of obesity to be eligible. And you also needed to have one weight-related comorbidity. Okay, so you had to have one weight-related comorbidity. The BMI level could drop if you had lots of weight-related comorbidities, i.e. were very, very ill. But otherwise, the cutoff is a BMI of 35.
And how do you feel about that? Do you think that's an appropriate level? Is that a decent group of participants?
Well, I think the drug is expensive and its availability is limited, you have to be selective where you use it. So obviously you want to treat the people most at risk, which would be those which are heaviest or those which are already presenting the multiple comorbidities because of their excessive body weight.
Yeah. Now, you say it's expensive. Can you give us some kind of sense of the scale of the expense?
Well, the cost of the drug varies around the world, so it's very difficult to say, but it can be in the region of $1,000 in the US for a month. It's interesting that the actual amount the NHS is going to pay for it is a commercial secret almost. So we don't really know yet how much the NHS will be paying. I should imagine it will be under the level that you can get it on private prescription. But as I say, the amount you pay on private prescription across the world varies greatly.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, how liberal can GPs be with prescribing it? I mean, the BMI of over 35, it's pretty clear. Do they have to try other treatments first? I mean, what about non-pharmacological interventions?
Well, it's interesting. Originally, the drug through the NICE recommendations were meant to be given in Tier 3 and Tier 4 specialist services. So that's not designed for a GP per se.
But can you just explain what those tiers mean?
Well, a Tier 3 is a specialist weight management service, usually located in hospital with a multidisciplinary team supporting you, nutrition, dietetics, physiotherapy, behavioural support, perhaps some psychological support as well. Yeah. A Tier 4 is pretty much the same, but a Tier 4 then allows you to go on to have bariatric surgery. Okay, so that's surgery for weight loss. which is obviously at the very far end of medical intervention. So what the government is trying to do is produce a similar sort of setup, but in primary care. And this is where we have some kind of issues, but I'll talk about that in a second. It's still in primary care, will be as an adjunct to other treatments, and non-medical treatments will have to be tried beforehand. So you don't go straight to drug. You've got to try a number of other things and show sustained commitments to those things, or at least perseverance with those things, before you'll have access to the drug. Now, as I say, unfortunately, there's not sufficient support in primary care for this, which is one of the major problems that we have. And another major problem we have is there are a few healthcare practitioners, be GPs or practice nurses, who are trained in nutrition, weight management or obesity. Obesity doesn't really crop up on the medical curriculum.
Mm-hmm. So what is it? You mentioned that you have certain issues with it. Can you expand on that a little bit more?
Well, I think, you know, there's some things around the specialist weight management support that you could get around with perhaps some telemedicine that can support healthcare practitioners, which could be provided centrally. So some services can be rolled down to primary care. Obviously, that needs investment, and that also needs a lot of training. But I think one of the things you've got to remember is these are very potent drugs. They're very, very powerful in the best sense of the word, but also the worst sense of the word. They have quite potent side effects. You've got to monitor them. You've got to slowly increase the dose up to 16 weeks before you reach full dose. And that titration process requires close medical supervision over that 16 weeks. And for that to be successful, healthcare practitioners need to be aware and understand the side effects and really prepare the patient for these. Because you can imagine it could be quite a tremendous shock. Feeling, you know, ill, having diarrhea, constipation, nausea, amongst other things. And these effects can be quite pronounced when you start the drug, even at the lower doses.
So am I getting the sense that you are slightly worried that this is might be used as a bit of a shortcut, and that you'd be shortchanging the patient with clinical care by shifting to this too early? Is that a worry for you?
Well, Stefan, the point of these drugs is they're only an adjunct, an addition to changes in diet, changes in lifestyle, changes in activity, which you want to support. Now, the drugs address a point issue for people living with obesity. In fact, their biology does not help them. They don't have effective appetite control. And in a food environment that promotes overconsumption, they are vulnerable. So what we're doing is we're boosting that appetite control. They don't feel in control. We're giving them pharmacotherapy to help restore control. But the pharmacotherapy is meant to be an adjunct. It's not an alternative to. And there are lots of issues related to obesity and its causes, which are outside the realms of appetite control, which are not addressed by pharmacotherapy. Pharmacotherapy is treating a symptom. It's not a cure.
Yeah, so you're tackling the symptom, not the problem, which I guess is feels like the wrong way around. Now, earlier I mentioned to our other guest on this episode, Adam Collins from the University of Surrey, that a study found that participants regained 2/3 of their weight loss after treatment ended with semaglutide. That presumably must be a worry as well. And if that's the case, why do you think semaglutide is getting so much attention and support?
Well, it depends how you view obesity. I review, like WHO and the EU and various other medical organisations globally and nationally, of obesity as a chronic relapsing disease. There is no cure. There is only management. As I said, the drug is an adjunct to effective management tool, and it will be helpful for some people and they'll continue with it. But like other conditions such as high blood pressure or chronic pain, if you stop taking the treatment, the symptoms by and large return. That said, ideally, the treatment should provide opportunities to experience functional appetite and change eating behaviours and engage in more weight loss activity. And what we need to do when we bring people off the drugs is help continue those behaviours and help support these so it provides a defence against weight gain. However, you know, the biology of obesity and the obesogenic environment works to undermine appetite control. So without the drug, without that extra support, people are vulnerable and we have to manage that vulnerability. And I think what we need to do is we take care titrating people on the drug, or we should be taking care titrating people on the drug, as I mentioned before. I think we also need to take equal care titrating people off the drug and monitoring the impact of that slow withdrawal of the drug on people living with obesity and their ability to manage appetite, eating behaviour and other aspects as they slowly lose that adjunct pharmacotherapy, that adjunct support.
And Do you see that aspect of it being part of this new project to assess the drug? Is that being incorporated into the study?
I think it's too early to tell. There's not sufficient details out there. And I don't think it's that actual aspect is actually part of normal care, really, either. So I think actually that would be something I would encourage, whether it's given in private practice, whether it's given in very specialist weight management services, or whether it's actually rolled out into this GP. This kind of de-escalation and care post-drug, I think, is very critical. And we just don't have the data on how to successfully manage people off these drugs.
Yeah, which sounds to be pretty crucial. Now, you've mentioned, and UK officials have explained, that clinical trials show that semaglutide can be effective alongside physical activity and behavioural support, diet changes, all these issues. Now, again, these other aspects are still expensive. And you know, we know that the NHS is being squeezed like no other time before. How can we be sure that patients will receive the proper support alongside their prescription, you know, especially when accessing services can be really challenging right now?
Yeah, well, there's a short-term answer to this and the long-term answer. I'll go with the long-term first. We know that obesity, the disease, leads to other NCDs and also worsens the outcome of infectious diseases. We saw that in COVID. So if we don't deal with obesity, the NHS will come under increasing strain as we move forward. So something has to be done. But here's the challenge. The NHS has not had a great track record developing and sustaining effective weight management services. It sets them up. They don't get recommissioned. They move. They fall pieces, they're reassembled somewhere else, you know, so it's not only availability, it's continuity of care, which has been a real problem. And as I mentioned, there is more generally a problem around HCP training around nutrition and obesity, which is limited to non-existent. And of course, you need that education in for those healthcare practitioners to understand the problem, to understand the patients that they're presented with, and to understand potential solutions as well. Now, again, there is an issue around HCPs misunderstanding the causes of obesity and just putting it down to lifestyle factors, patients' lack of motivation to lose weight, and there's a lot of stigma and weight bias around there. And that's prevalent in health services just as much as it's prevalent in the population as a whole. And that gets reflected back to people living with obesity and worsens their experience of healthcare services, which means they disengage. So there's lots of things to work out there, which, you know, it's a challenge. We'll work through them all. And I think there's a new generation of healthcare practitioners who are really engaged and who are listening to their patients, who are trying to understand obesity as a disease. But they're going out there seeking this information. They're not being given this information in their routine training.
I guess long-term strategic thinking is what's needed here, and I think many would say that the government hasn't allowed the NHS to provide that by underfunding. Would you agree with that, or is that skirting around the issues?
Well, I think, you know, there's lots of different diseases and they all can make an argument for support. But what I will say is NCDs have been particularly underinvested in compared with infectious disease. And that's not just a problem for the UK. That's a problem globally across Western society. We invest in infectious disease much more than we invest in non-communicable disease. But non-communicable diseases are the things that we have the problems with. But within the non-communicable disease portfolio, there is very little funding for obesity compared with diabetes, cardiovascular and cancer. And we know that obesity is a major risk factor for all three of those and many things beyond.
Yeah. Now, concerns have been raised around semaglutide increasing the risk of developing damaging relationships with weight and, you know, between weight and food in people that suffer. Are these likely risk factors for patients? How likely are they, and particularly post-treatment when people are left to manage their weight themselves?
I mean, this is the interesting things. We've never had drugs so powerful before, and I use the word powerful cautiously, but they are very, very powerful. They alter hunger and satiety, the homeostatic aspects of eating behaviour, reward-driven eating, so the motivation to eat, but also the enjoyment of food. They reduce cravings and they boost people's ability to resist. So they're really simultaneously hitting that homeostatic, hedonic and cognitive mechanisms implicated in the overall control of eating behaviour. And this results in a reduction in, say, test meals, when we see it in the lab, of 36%. Per meal energy intake. Again, twice as much as of any of their predecessors. So you're really going to notice this when you're on the drug. And that's why, you know, they're producing, you know, 16 to 20% weight loss, depending on which of the new generation drugs that you're using, but 16% for semaglutide. So that's going to have real changes, radical changes into your experience with food. Now, for some patients, this is great. I mean, some people will say it was like somebody flipped a switch in my head and suddenly I was back in control and it wasn't a problem. That's absolutely great. But for others, it will radically alter their experience of eating in unpleasant ways, including the negation in any enjoyment in the act of eating. And anhedonia is not a good state to be in. You know, so a lack of enjoyment is, and you can imagine the psychological consequences of that as well. So we really need to, again, be monitoring the patients and how they respond to the drugs. And I think, you know, there you need to really look at their relationship and how it's dealing. And it may not work for some people, but ultimately, people living with obesity, considering pharmacotherapy, need to be informed of these possible outcomes. So they need to be informed in advance and supported through them, both on getting onto the drug, but also, again, we talked about coming off, that titrated coming off as well. As I say, you know, these are, you see it all on the social media, the TikTok and the off-label use stuff, which comes from America. I hear this morning TikTok are actually trying to reduce the number of TikToks about weight management medications because they're absorbing the media. And you can see how really bizarre people's experiences are taking these drugs. I would point out that some of this drug taking has been off-label, and these are not the appropriate people to be taking these drugs, and the effects may be more potent because they've not got BMIs above 35, so you can imagine the drug is much more potent in them because they've got a lower body weight. But that shows the range, possibly the extremes of experience that you can have on these drugs.
Yeah. Now, are you confident that the pilot scheme is going to analyse the psychological impact? Because, I mean, it didn't really strike me, I think, until you mentioned it then, that you know, if you don't enjoy food, I mean, that completely changes your relationship with some of the most important features of life and family and relationships.
It's never really, because the drugs have never been this powerful before and hit all aspects of eating behaviour directly and indirectly in the mechanism underpinning it. It's never really been an issue. But there was one drug before called Rimonabant. It was an endocannabinoid antagonist and it was meant to dampen down the reward aspects of eating behaviour. But it did actually dampen down some of the enjoyments of other areas of life, and there was a bit of suicide ideation there. And certainly some people on the trials I was involved in reported a reduction in libido as well. So I wonder how generalizing these reward dampening effects of these drugs are, and we really do not know. We know that they might be good for dealing with, say, alcohol reduction as well, so they might dampen down their need for alcohol, but there's other aspects of reward systems that you wouldn't want to dampen down. And so we really don't know how generalizable this reward effect is, so that I think in my mind I have some questions there. Now the drug, you know, for purposes of approval, they will look at psychiatric side effects, but they won't look any deeper than that. They won't look in any more nuanced way. And I think there really is, for this whole class of drugs coming in, and there's, you know, there are more drugs from this manufacturer, there's more drugs from at least three other manufacturers with similar mechanisms. And I think we really do need to sit back and go, actually, we really need to understand what these powerful interventions are doing in terms of people's relationship to eating behaviour, the mood, psychiatric help, but what might be the broader effects on reward-driven behaviour as well, which are non-food.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wondered, do you buy the economic argument? I mean, a grand a month is pretty expensive, but then how does that compare with dealing with, you know, other, you know, the comorbidity issues of people with high BMIs? And is the economic argument, is that just a bit reductionist in your view?
Well, they will have won the economic argument through their NICE clearance, because NICE really focuses on the value for money. So obviously, I mean, I don't know what they're paying, but obviously the health economics has been worked out. But what I will say is, as production increases, as demand increases, production costs should come down. And as rivals enter the market, and Lilly's got one coming in, Novo Nordisk has got some coming in, Boehringer Ingelheim have got some coming in, Pfizer have got some coming in, and these are big portfolios of things, you know, there is going to be competition as well. So that should drive price down as well. So as you ramp up and scale with production, as more drugs come in, as there's more competition, you can imagine the price points holding. But I take it back to my earlier comment that if you're not dealing with obesity, you're not dealing with other non-communicable diseases along the line. So you'll have a burden of diabetes in 5 years, and you'll have a burden of cardiovascular health in 10 years. And depending on the cancers, they may appear from 10 to 15 years later down the line. And that, those are just some conditions. There are others such as, you know, obviously deterioration in bone health, physical deterioration, problems with fertility, problems with mental health as well. You know, the link between mental health and obesity is significant. You see that from childhood. If you're going to do anything about mental health, certainly in adolescence, you need to be dealing with obesity.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you flagged many, many issues about using this. I mean, I guess it comes back to this idea of, you know, education with kids and policy, government policy to affect people's buying habits and things like that. None of these have either worked or the governments haven't persevered with them. What would you like to see happening maybe including this drug, but how would you like obesity to be tackled going ahead?
Yeah, I think the problem with our field is we've had this false dichotomy between policy and treatment, and they're really not all that different. Obviously, you want to, policy is largely around prevention, and we failed. And I wouldn't say that's a failure of people in policy. It's the fact that we're not able to implement enough policies. There's no single policy. You need a broad portfolio of policies to do this. I've worked on reducing advertising to children, and 20 years I've been campaigning for that 9 o'clock watershed, and we've just got that now. That's 20 years. Just that in and of itself will have no difference, because you've got to do all sorts of policies around portion size, about promotion, about taxation, You've got to change the whole entire food system and get a food system which is based around nutrition, not about calories, you know, that whole food economics thing. So it's an entire big piece of work to do. We cannot abandon current generations of people living with obesity, so we need treatment. We have to have treatment. So, you know, you can't say, well, policy will solve it all. It won't. We'll have lost generations and the impact in terms of our healthcare systems and the impact, you know, the disastrous impact it will have on that. But ultimately, the comprehensive changes we need to make to the food systems, the radical ones, are actually will also help people living with obesity on treatment, because it's that same toxic environment that causes obesity that undermines obesity management. So the two things are not different. You need both. And we really need to get past this false dichotomy of saying, well, actually, giving people drugs is just annoying all this public health stuff. It's not. It's actually providing individuals with the solutions they need. You know, you can't pin these individuals to the cross of public health. We need to help them as well as deal with the public health challenges that we face.
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost as though you need long-term strategic thinking that doesn't get ditched before implementation. But we can only hope for the best. Okay, Jason Holford, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much, Stefan.